With me in studio today is Freeman Nomvalo. He's, of course, the CEO of the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants, or SAICA. Freeman, welcome to the show. You've been at SAICA since the beginning of February, so that is only 3 months. But with your appointment, you were given a very tough mandate, and that is to restore the trust in the chartered accountancy profession. And the reputation of the CA profession was, of course, criticized following several accounting scandals in the private and public sector where CAs were involved. What do you think the current perceptions are by the different stakeholders, prospective CAs, current CAs, and the public of SAICA?
Good day, Rick. It is indeed a tough job. The reputation of the profession has taken a big knock. I have had interactions with a number of stakeholders. I've met members, I've had a roadshow with the members. All of them are concerned about the reputation of the profession. And the business community is concerned, obviously. But we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that this profession, especially in South Africa, yes, it has taken a knock, but it has always been on top of the world for many, many years. Nothing much has changed in terms of the way we train, the way we develop standards and all of that, except that obviously there has been some excesses in the past that have affected the profession negatively. So there is optimism around, but obviously there is concern that unless we act and act quickly, the perceptions will persist.
What will you do to address those perceptions?
First, the obvious things is that we should continue with the things we've done to improve our training. We should continue to ensure that our members understand the ethical code. It has been revised recently. We've revised the Code of Professional Conduct to align with the IESBA Code of Professional of Ethics. And all of those things help members to understand how to conduct themselves when they're faced with different ethical questions. We also need to make sure that in the event that members are not conducting themselves appropriately, we hold them accountable. And all of those things are happening. The Institute in the past 12 months has saw it fit to look at its governance processes. The board established the governance review task team. The work of that task team is about finished, and the board will be considering that tomorrow. So there are actions that are being taken that are intended to improve our governance, but also improve our response time.
But are you holding your members accountable? There have been criticism from, and I can think of Linda De Beer and even Eric Venter from ComAir regarding delays in actually taking steps against CAs who were actively involved in the accounting scandals at Gupta Companies, at Eskom, at Steinhoff, where the CAs involved remain members of SAICA.
Yes, we are holding our members accountable. The first point that I think I need to make, which you will obviously know, is that any form of retributive justice is seldom a sharp instrument in dealing with errant people. Whether you're thinking about fighting fraud and corruption, whether you're thinking about fighting members who are not holding up to the code. And the reason for that is a simple one. One, you've got to establish that there's wrongdoing, which, and not anecdotally, factually, you've got to be clear that there is wrongdoing and this is the nature of the wrongdoing. Once you've established that, you've got to go through a process of holding those accountable, hearing their side of the story and coming to a determination whether after all those processes you still are of the view that there is something that they've done wrong or the allegations were unfounded, and then meet whatever sanction that is necessary. So all those things normally take time before, because you've got to operate within the rules of administrative justice as well. So those things take time. So understandably, when the damage to the reputation is to the extent that it has been, you are bound to find people being impatient. You are bound to find people wanting to see action and see action quicker. But we don't have the luxury as an institute to act without sufficient evidence and sufficient proof that something has happened and the specific person we're dealing with is in fact the person that is accountable for that action.
Let's take Marcus Huster as an example. Implosion of Steinhoff happened in late 2017. That is nearly 18 months ago. Number one, who should find the wrongdoing? And number two, what is Syco's role in also trying to come to grips with actually what happened and what his contribution or how, you know, what his transgressions were?
Obviously, I will not be able to deal with the specifics of the case, but I will attempt to answer your question as best as I can. The issue came to public light, as you say, about 18 months ago. The concrete evidence relating to the issue, the very first report, of course, you've had at least two books written, and you journalists have got a way of getting information that we don't necessarily have. But the first concrete report that comes out of the process was published just about a month or so ago. And we have requested to have access to that report because then we can deal with tangible evidence that would be available to us in order to deal with this issue. Now, part of your question is who should do what? The case of Marcus Huster, obviously, he is not a practicing auditor, so Syco would have to deal with that. But for all the other matters where there are auditors involved, those people have to be dealt with by ERBA, and they do take action as well after following their processes. So in relation to this particular one, the difficulty has been having credible evidence that we can deal with. Obviously, we now are at a position where if obviously the company cooperates with us, we'll be able to move quicker. We're also looking at other avenues of accessing information. When you read the books relating to this particular matter, there are several instances which have been before the courts of law, and that would be a matter of public record. We are in the process of accessing some of that information so that we can establish whether from that information there is sufficient evidence that we can utilize in dealing with this matter.
There has been criticism of the process, and I hear what you're saying, but in other professions like the medical sector, you see doctors being suspended when there are certain allegations made against them,
yeah.
Some senior state officials, private sector officials, even teachers. Why can't you then just create a way to suspend a member provisionally until he or she is found guilty? And that is a process that has been called for by members. Why hasn't that happened?
The process has been called for by members. Yes, in the roadshow, I also experienced that. But members have to influence also a change in the regulations that govern how we operate as the Secretariat. Now, if I were to go out on a limb and suspend people, I do not have an empowering provision in the bylaws, in the Constitution, I would be doing exactly the same thing that I'm trying to get people to hold people accountable for. So I also have to follow the framework that I have been given, and that framework, as we speak, does not have a provision for suspension. Members have called for it, and I think members have got to be a little bit more vigilant to ensure that we do an act that, as a functionary, I operate within the rules that have been decided upon by members as well as the board.
Isn't that the core of addressing the negative perceptions of the profession?
I think it will go a long way to address that perception. When you have it, though, you also still need to make sure that you exercise that with caution, you exercise that with a sense of responsibility, because in the event you get it wrong, there would be consequences. But if you then approach it with reason, with approach it sensibly, you would minimize those chances and, in fact, improve the image of the profession. I think it will contribute positively, but you first have to make sure that you've got a framework that allows you to do so.
Do you think the criticism is fair? You know, in other industries, if an engineer, for example, doesn't do his or her job and a bridge collapse, it doesn't, my perception is that it doesn't reflect badly on the whole profession. But do you think the criticism you have received following the conduct of a few of your members is fair?
Look, I think most of the criticism comes from a good place, comes from people who care about the contribution this profession is making to the investment appeal of our country. So I wouldn't want to judge that criticism. However, you make an example of a bridge. When a bridge falls, you've got the evidence in front of you. For instance, think about the issues relating to Steinhoff. When you read the literature that's been written on this, a lot of these things happened over a long period of time. Yet it imploded only in 2017. So there is a difference in the nature of the evidence that we're looking at in relation to accounting malpractices as opposed to a bridge falling. That's an important issue to understand.
Yes, I agree. That's a very good point. But again, your mission is to protect the integrity of the industry, and then your whole mission statement lists a few things which you are responsible for. Can we expect more decisive action being taken? I know these things take time. It is complicated, as you've said. It took PwC a very long time to actually issue its first version of a report. What can CAs expect will happen from PsychoSide in the near future?
Well, hopefully, with the conclusion of the governance review process, we hope that at some point, the revision of the bylaws, the revision of the constitution that would follow that process would take a leaf from other institutes around the world that have began to deal with this issue, i.e. the call by members for suspensions. Hopefully we will get to that point having analyzed the pros and cons and figured out how to do it and do it in a responsible manner. Hopefully we'll get to that point pretty soon, because if we get to that point, then at least those members who would have been falsely accused would want to cooperate very quickly to clear their names, to get their designation back. And only those that have got something to hide would take us to task. So I think there would be positive things that would come out of that.
Why hasn't that revision taken place already?
Well, the GRTT was only established sometime last year, and they've got a two-phase approach to the work that they are doing. And the first phase is just being concluded now, and there's a lot of valuable work that will come out of that that will inform what the next steps ought to be.
Just lastly, MoneyWeb recently published an article analyzing the failure rates of the Psyche exam. The exams took place late last year, and the failure rate was significantly higher than in previous years. It
yes.
was 32% for that particular exam compared to 11 and 20% for previous years. And there was an inference drawn that this may be an effort by Psyche to increase standards. Psyche was unhappy with that inference. What is the story here? Why was the failure rate so high? And what is Psyche's position regarding it?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question. Definitely Psyche would not and is not trying to manipulate the results in order to, in fact, the results would not necessarily contribute positively one way or the other to the appeal of the profession. The things that the people who are CAs are able to do and contribute in society are the things that make the appeal. So what has gone wrong with these results? There's a few things. We had a number of instances of trainees who wrote the first part, which is the ITC, in June, and wrote the APC, which is the final assessment, in November. That time period is proving to be too short a time period for that to happen. And the majority of those trainees did not do well. There was an increase also in the number of trainees that are coming from long distance environment in terms of their university training. And we have to figure out what the issue there is, because they did go through the ITC, and perhaps that time frame, the runway for preparation for the APC wasn't good enough. And of course, the APC assesses the ability of people to execute their competence. To the extent that people have not had the right exposure, that would affect them. And we've asked a number of the trainees, and there are trainees in the number of those that did not make it, that have indicated that some of the exposure wasn't as adequate as it could have been. So it's a number of factors, and all of those factors are being considered. We are looking to ensure that we, whatever pass rate we have, that pass rate should always be a reflection of how able those individuals that have passed have proved to be, rather than focus on saying we're always going to have a 10% failure rate only. So we are responding to the issue, but also we are mindful of the fact that as the years go by, issues getting more and more complex, and the assessment begins to incorporate more and more things, you are probably not going to continuously maintain a certain level. But the drop was significant to warrant us to be able to look at it and see what can be done to improve.
So it was an anomaly.
It is an anomaly.
Freeman, thank you so much for joining us, and good luck with your task.
Thank you.
That was Freeman Nomvalo. He is the CEO of Syka.